Welcome to Words First, talking text in opera. Today's episode is an interview with Michael Mori, the Artistic and General Director of Tapestry Opera in Toronto, the Chair of the Association for Opera in Canada, and a lauded stage director. We talk about Tapestry's commitment to fostering contemporary opera, as well as their composer-librettist program called LibLab, which has been putting together talent since 1995. Before that, however, I had a lovely conversation with baritone Robert Wesley Mason about how he learns new work and about his love and respect for Royce Vavreck's words in Royce and Missy Mazzoli's 2016 opera, Breaking the Waves.
I brought the epilogue / aria, Jan's aria, from Missy Mazzoli's and Royce Vavreck's Breaking the Waves. And this one kind of came in mind when the question was proposed, like, you know, what's a piece of text that has really sat with you and impacted you? And there's a number of places my mind went to. But this is one that really stands out to me, and especially, with its structure and what it achieves, not just dramatically, but what it achieves by just tying back so much of the piece through this beautiful, heartbreaking, like screaming in the wind testimony that Jan gives.
Can you put it in a little bit of context? I mean, that's beautiful poetic context. Can you put it into a little bit of sort of storytelling context as well as where we are with these words?
Yeah. Gosh, where do I even begin?
Okay, yeah. That's fair.
Set up the context of this piece and its nuance. You know, spoiler alert, spoilers ahead. This is your opportunity. If you've not seen the opera or the film by Lars von Trier, you are going to want to skip over this part. But, you know, essentially we're at the end of this piece where this tragic accident occurred on an oil rig that my character, the baritone character Jan, is working on right after his wedding night, essentially, to the main character Bess, which leaves him paralyzed. And, you know, a big connection in their love was through physical connection and physical expression. But without that outlet available to him, or at least seemingly available to him in that position, led him to ask her to seek out other lovers and to come back and share those stories with him so that he can still be connected, to that experience in some way. Doesn't really work out, as you can imagine, for a number of reasons. But eventually, arguably, it's what ends up leading to Bess's death, brutal death, and sacrifice, ultimately, as we find out at the very end of the piece. But in this moment, she, you know, what also the context that's helped is she's part of a strict Calvinist interpretation of Christianity. Who has condemned her soul to hell and buried her as a sinner, to be, you know, to never enter the place of heaven and all the wonderful goody things that a good girl is supposed to get. You know what I mean?
Right.
And, Jan, along with his friends, who ultimately ends up recovering and can walk, not perfectly, but can walk again, steals her body. Before they're able to bury her in this, and condemn her in this horrible funeral. And then takes her body away and commits it to the sea, from the oil rig, and with his friend Terry, and from the help of some others. And it's just devastating.
Can you read me a few of these words?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I'd be happy to.
It's nice to hear it once you've told it, said it, to hear it in your voice too, you know?
Yeah. I think that was the best Cliff Notes version I can get.
That was pretty good. Yeah, that was pretty well done.
There's so much more I'd love to dive in about this piece because it means so much to me, especially with the friends of mine that are tetraplegic, members of the SCI community. But here's the text. "My Bess, I've stolen you back. Husband and wife must talk. Can you hear me? Bess, it should have been me. It should have been me. I was meant to die. But your love, it kept me alive. I stole you, Bess. I stole you back. Your body is a map. Bess begins here. I begin and end here. You told me not even in death will our paths unwind. Wait for me until I too can rest on the seafloor. Wait for me. Wait for me, Bess. Wait for me. In the whirlpools, in the currents of the Little Minch, my Bess. Dear God, I thank you for the greatest gift. What powers you possess. What powers you possess. What goodness. What goodness you possess."
Wow. When I have people read, usually the next question that I ask them is, do these words resonate without the music? And I kind of feel silly asking that question right now. because I would say that they do, at least on my end, they do. You know, I think it's always an interesting thing that the way that music and words knit together and what they do. And so I think the question I'm going to ask you is, do you feel, I mean, clearly we can feel just by the way you read them, the power that they have over you and with you as you say them. Do you feel that the music elevates them? What does the music do to these words to complete or push forward Jan's notion of love?
Absolutely. You know, there's a reason why this piece is so popular. Mm. And oh my God, I can't even believe I'm going to admit this out loud, but when I first saw it, I hated it. I hated it mostly because I didn't have, you know, I was not familiar with this piece at all. I did not know what I was walking into witness and take in. Mm-hmm. And that might say maybe a bit more about me than it does, of course, the piece itself.
Sure.
I just really wasn't ready for the storytelling that was presented. And so when I came back around to this piece and was able to really remove my biases from it and really take in the story and really see the main themes and the way the music just, I mean, this is one of the most operatic stories I could ever, ever even imagine.
Right.
And it's interesting. And I say, like, why I struggled with it too, I imagine is the same reason that this film still divides feminists. In a very clear way, in certain ways. I can't speak for others, but I do know that it's like this 50-50 between, you know, Lars von Trier is quite controversial, but his filmmaking is enchanting. I don't know, not enchanting. It's like looking at this beautiful painting, a violent painting, but this painting that's so vivid in color that you can't look away. And now I'm a bit off the topic, getting back to the music. Yes, this what Missy and Royce achieved in their collaboration for me is like the best of what they do when they come together.
Right.
Because Royce has this style that he achieves a lot with very little. There's not a lot of fat in his text.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's really great about getting something across in two words and, mm-hmm. and two lines, just right down to the consonants.
Mm-hmm.
And Missy's music fills out the exposition of each sentence, mm-hmm. like the full background and what's happening and how it is in just the most incredibly powerful way. And there, I've seen very few teams achieve what they achieve in this piece, and especially in this particular aria in the end. It reaches right in to your chest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it really just reaches right in there. And I can't imagine the music without the text and vice versa in some ways.
Yeah. And, you know, I hear that over and over again. And I feel like those are the pieces that really hit you, right? The ones that the music and the text are so intertwined that it's almost difficult to extract one from the other. And I think that says a lot about the alchemy of the two artists that are putting it together. So what's the phrase? And it can be from a musical space or from a textual space, but what's the phrase inside of that aria that really, what do you feel like is the crux in there?
Your body is a map. Best begins here. I begin and end here.
Yeah.
And God, I can talk about this piece all day. At that moment, you know, musically what happens is it pulls back and just these little tremolos and the strings. And then it's asked of the baritone to float this text in the upper register. And your body is a map, best begins here, I begin and end here, is a motif we find again and again and again in this piece, in the text. This whole aria is pretty much all the motifs established in the entire show. And I haven't come across pieces that have achieved something like that. But once we get to your body is a map, The first part, you know, my best, I've stolen you back, husband and wife must talk. That's another motif. Husband and wife must talk is early established by the priest. And the music is churning along, and it has this big romantic intro because we reveal Jan is actually alive and back, and we see him with crutches coming back on. And it's first just this kind of bellowing that comes out, and the music is still very... the vocal line is still very full and cavalier-like.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get, I stole you best, bah, bah. I stole you back, dum. And then it pulls back for this moment that's from the love duet.
Mm-hmm.
And we're best introduced this text,
mm-hmm.
about your body as a map. And when we staged it, you know, this was the first time that Jan pulled back the sheet to look and see Bess's face. Good job, Mark Straczynski. That one's already still hitting me here. And Sarah Lamesh for her performance. You know, and then suddenly you're repeating that theme, this motif for the last time and saying goodbye. But it's quiet and intense. And it's mm-hmm. It's this moment where it really does feel like the two of them, and they're in that spotlight. You know, Terry's off to the side there being a good friend and supportive, but like you get, the audience gets to just really have to lean forward.
Yeah.
You know, and it's tough. That part's really tricky to do.
There's something about those quiet moments, right? I mean, we think of opera as being so bombastic in a lot of ways, and I think it's the space in between. It's those super quiet moments that really make a piece what it is. It's a concept in dance that we talk about all the time. It's that, you know, like if you are standing next to somebody, it's not the bodies that matter. It's that space in between the palms, you know? I mean, that's the important part. That's the part that makes an audience sit forward, is that emptiness. And I think that when you can put that into actual existing music, it changes the way an audience deals. You know, an audience can sit back and hear bombastic stuff and be like, oh, opera, I'm listening to opera. But when they really have to sit forward into it, changes the way that they connect to the piece. I'm always drawn to the pieces that can do that. It's really,
of course. And I mean, it's that balance is so important, because you can't really appreciate bombastic music without something compare it to. It's like, it's, you're really grateful for the good things because of the bad.
That's right.
You know, yeah. That spectrum, you understand that spectrum. And the same applies for music, you know. If it's monotonous and hitting you at the same point over and over and over and over again, you move on.
Yeah. If all you're doing is shouting, after a while, people stop listening.
Like, okay. That's what often happened in my auditions.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I'm just shouting at these people.
Oh, man. When you learn a piece of music, this is a slight departure, but I'm... When you get a new piece of music, because this is a new piece of music within the last few years, so you know, as you pick it up and learn it, how do you approach it? Words first, or do you approach it music first, or do you do it at the same time? I'm always curious how singers approach text.
You know, it comes down to deadlines.
Really?
Yeah, it comes down to deadlines. Ideally, you know, and I know lots of people love to talk about, like, oh yes, you know, I start with the text and then I speak it, and then, you know, then I sing all the notes in a neutral vowel, and then I bring the text together, and then that's great, and that's ideally what we'd like to do, and that's my approach too. Preferably I got time, right?
Yeah,
it's a year out or something. If I don't have a bunch of projects stacked against it, I go through the core. I try my best to find, you know, what's very helpful sometimes is when some of the newer scores, they've been putting the libretto in with the score. I think the 3 December score is printed that way.
I love that.
And I just appreciate that so much, because...
As One was like that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's so helpful. I remember specifically in an As One rehearsal with a director, like taking up and us going to the text.
Yeah.
Away from the music.
Yeah.
And I would start with the text ideally. And I like to start with the text from the libretto specifically, without the music, because it's all being set and it gets broken up, you know. And this is doubly it's double true for me in foreign languages, especially.
Yes,
I
of
really
course.
Have to get the structure of it spoken out.
I would think probably, especially in recit pieces, would be just incredibly
pieces. Ooh, yeah. Big time. And like, I am a big fan of the come scritto school, you know, as written. Mm-hmm. I start there so that I can move away from it in case there's something I need to discuss with the music director and conductor in the moment. And we need to get back to the facts of what's written and what's intended. And then I can, whatever version I brought, I can switch back to like, okay, if we want to get this way and everything. But process wise, I do like to start with the text and try and use it as much as a script as I possibly can. And it comes out kind of awkward sometimes, because, you know, it's not a script.
Right.
It's just not. We're, you know, if because you're not saying my best has stolen you back, husband and wife must talk, can you hear me? It's my best, I've stolen you back. You know, you can't, you're dictated by the music.
Of course. It's also not, and it's not written to be spoken. And that's, no. You know, it's an exercise that is important and it's an important part of the process. But I do find that, you know, when you get a libretto and you read it and you're like, oh, this sounds perfectly fine being spoken. Oftentimes you get it into the music and you're like, oh no.
Yeah. And that's the thing is like, this is where I get so excited. For me, this is what separates us from straight acting.
Mm.
Because I get, you know, get that text, but then I see how this form is in text by the markings.
Mm.
How the composer set the text.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm like, okay, cool. And like, I get the monotonous stuff out of the way. Make sure I can say it. Get the rhythm, like rhythm is where it's at for me, because I have a very strong ear. I can fix pitches, no problem. It's about rhythm. And then trying to get also starting, make sure I'm singing through this piece just for the athletic aspect of being prepared to sustain these vocal lines and get through them. But the colors and bringing that all together, that's all the dynamics. And like, that's the benefit and as opera singers and as musical actors and interpreters, you know, we have our ideas that we get to bring to the table, but you just get this amazing starting point. You know,
yeah.
You get this huge, this wonderful roadmap laid out for you by the composer, and you're able to communicate with them without even having to talk to them.
I have this, I've had a couple of people come and talk to me, have likened it to Shakespeare. If you really want to liken it to some sort of theater, that opera, it's not that you can't interpret it or that you can't put your spin on it, but the structure is so strong that you're just in a tighter box. So you just have to press a little harder up against the sides to put out your own interpretation of things. I find that fascinating that's how it works.
Yeah.
Structural.
100% it is. And there's freedom in that structure.
Yeah, for sure. And that's the cool thing. That's what I keep trying to tell people when I talk to theater people who are like, don't you feel really hemmed in by the music? I mean, even as a director, don't you feel hemmed in? You've got six bars to complete this. You can't. I'm like, no, that's what makes it interesting. It's a problem to be solved. I don't feel boxed in as much as I feel like, here are my parameters. Now, what cool thing can I accomplish within the space I've been given?
Exactly. And you've got these two or three co-conspirators with you already that you don't ever get when you have just a script. You
That's
know,
right.
You get just the text, but you get the music and the text.
Yes.
And it's just like, for me, what a gift. And I know everyone says that. Good Lord. I know we've been saying, but it's true, because suddenly I'm like, I have all these ideas, because all these ideas are being brought to the table for me, and they hit me differently, just like they're going to hit some other person who interprets it differently. And like, that's how we end up with all these different versions. Like, I love what Royce was saying the other day when you had him on, where he lets go of the baby and lets everyone else have a go at it after that premiere. And then suddenly you show up and you're seeing the same show, but you're seeing a totally different show.
That's
and
right.
I love that. I love that. Even if it's a show I don't enjoy.
Yeah, but that's part of it, right? I think, you know, every time you see something, you're honing your own thoughts about the piece, about how you would do the piece, about how you would interpret it on your own. I mean, it helps you bring in your own thoughts, you know. To seeing something you don't like is not, you know, it's what makes art, right? I love that we don't like everything. If everything was right to our taste, what a boring, what a boring space we would all occupy.
A boring space. you know, I just thought about that. I know it pertains to it was something we talked about earlier, but I really appreciate the way Missy listens to Royce. I can I know that there's a back and forth of course, and
sure.
I know they say that the best idea wins,
mm-hmm.
you know, but like, there's such a respect and reverence for his text. Like, for the reason why, like, Your Body Is a Map got quiet, you know, she saves the big wave and crescendo for a word like, dear God, I thank you for the greatest gift. And dear God is like a 9-beat fortissimo high F sharp.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that monotonous go, go, go that we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, it really, and it's not just a composer who's like, this text is pretty good and I'm just going to kind of set it, which has been, you know, I'll just kind of go with it and it'll work out, which has been happening for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can really tell the dialogue that's occurring between the creators to make something better, than the sum of their, you know, to make something better that neither of them could achieve on their own.
Right. Yeah. Wes, thank you.
And now, here's Michael Mori from our conversation on March 22nd.
Michael, welcome to Words First. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Oh, I'm super happy to be here. Thank you.
So, you're the artistic and general director of Tapestry Opera. You're the chair of the Association for Opera in Canada. You're the founder of Indie Opera TO, which is a group of small to medium companies in Toronto. You're an adjunct professor at the University of British Columbia and an accomplished stage director in your own right. So my first question is, how do you do all of these things at the same time and aren't you always exhausted?
I feel like... someone told me this when I was younger, and it's proven to be true, is if you do what you love, then your work isn't necessarily work. It's something that also fuels you. There is a tipping point, definitely. but yeah, I mean, I really love what I do, and I think, you know, I think there's a place for it. And so that's what keeps driving me, is that, you know, I love this genre. I love my city, and I love the kind of work that Tapestry engages with. And I think that, you know, we can all help in the evolution of the art form. And so that's kind of what drives me. And yeah, probably it's a lot. My dad's a Japanese businessman, and he's almost 70 and he's retired 6 times already. And, last time I checked, he still had 3 jobs. And I was like, telling him about how busy it was, he's like, this is good. This is what you do in your 30s and 40s, is you work your butt off so that you've made your career for the rest of your life. I'm like, it doesn't really work like that in the arts, but it kind of, maybe kind of.
It
sure.
Kind of, sort of, maybe, but yeah, yeah. But so you come by it honestly, it sounds like. It runs in the family.
Maybe.
Can you tell me, just because I'm always so interested in origin stories, can you just tell me a little bit about how you got into directing, which is, I'm assuming, your sort of your first foray into the whole world of running opera companies?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was a child performer, so I've been around, like, in opera, actually. I've been around opera for, like, around 30 years. And when I had the opportunity to direct, when I was in my master's for opera performance, mm-hmm. I really took to it. It sort of fit in with a bunch of the other ways that I sort of thought about the world you know, maybe like many of our generation, I've also seen a lot of opera productions where it fell short of what I knew it could do. And I thought that seems like the director's chair seems like a place where you could, make a difference. You could turn the dial in a way that would make, you know, my contemporaries be more turned on by it. Cause it was the thing that kept frustrating me, is that people would come and say, hey, I loved you in the show. So proud of you. Didn't really get it. It's not really my thing. And I'm like, it's not that it's not your thing. I think we could just do a better job of it. You know,
right.
I think there's a way to translate this for our generation. You know, in a way that may not make as much of a difference for the listening generation, the generation of our parents and their parents started their connection to opera through the radio and through records.
Right.
And so sometimes they just go for the sound and a bit of the spectacle. But our generation, like if the acting doesn't make sense or if the concept is too bizarre, there's like a disconnect, because we're far more visual because of how we grew up with TV and now the internet. So that was my in. I was like, there's a place for me to say something, because I love the power of this so much, and I'd like to see it have that impact on more people.
Yeah, I love that. I, you know, being a fellow director, I totally I feel that whole notion of, I just remember, you know, standing, watching shows, and the more I started thinking like, oh God, that should have been this way, or that should have been this way, or maybe if they did it a little more, I thought maybe I should try this myself if I have so many opinions about what it does. So yeah, I love that. I want to actually start, we'll talk about LibLab and stuff in a minute, but I do want to actually start talk to you just a bit as a stage director. And, you know, this is a podcast about words, and I want to know what your relationship as a stage director is to words and text when you're making work, and how they factor into both your preparation and your work in the room.
It's a big question. But yeah, sure. You know, words are the end. I feel like it's different depending on the language that you're working in, and because we get to work in other languages in opera.
Sure.
And I love language a lot. So I did a minor in German, and I studied sort of a number of years of Italian, and have been sort of continuing studies as my life has progressed. And I think there's always like unlocking truths in the words is really important to understanding what's trying to go on. Because if you're missing the fact that so many of the writers were also poets, or at least incorporated some element of poetry in, especially in other languages, then you're not playing the full scene, or you're not directing the full scene. So I would say that my approach, because I've been a musician my whole life, is usually to find interpretation based on the music. Mm-hmm. But also to like really explore what things can mean. Mm-hmm. And I love poetry. I love that a word can mean a number of things. I love that in German, the word for poetry is Gedicht, and that comes from Dichten, which is to actually like make things sewn together, or like to be tight. Like Wasserdicht is like things that are watertight. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's something incredible about that, because your human experience is more complex than a word. But words that are beautiful or that are truly effective can express more than one thing at a time. And that's what's the most human about them.
Yeah. That's really beautiful. I love that about the German word too. That's, there's something about the notion of poetry being the most economical way also to say something that speaks to that. Sort of etymology as well, which is really great. So I brought you here to talk about the new works that Tapestry is doing. Tapestry Opera is just, I've spoken to a number of people who've gone through LibLab and a number of people who've worked at Tapestry, and is one of your tenets of the company to foster new works? Is this part of the ethos of what the company is?
Yeah, I would say to foster contemporary works, because I think that there's a big difference between what's new and what's contemporary.
Sure.
Because I have heard people who have done world premieres, and I'm like, this easily could have been done 60 years ago and no one would have batted an eye. And I don't think that that's contemporary. I think you have to have an argument for why the work that you create and bring into the world as a producer or a composer or librettist, why does it belong to us? Mm-hmm. And so that is Tapestry's mandate. We commission, develop, and produce new works, and that is our core mandate.
Do you do works that aren't new? Is there any sort of mix inside of your seasons, or is it entirely based on works that are being created now?
We've gone back as old as like 15 years ago.
Okay.
Occasionally.
Yeah. All right.
But it's rare. It's rare. Like maybe once every 3 years we'll do something that's been premiered before. I'm very open to that. I think that's one thing about not, you know, the world being a huge place in terms of like who can actually get to where. If there's a worthy work, we're definitely interested. Mm-hmm. But we've only recently sort of broken the $1 million budget mark. So
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. Possibilities are not endless, but I'm interested, because I think for me, again, it's about the conversation about what is contemporary. And you mentioned etymology. I love it. You know, contemporary is with the times.
Yeah.
So what are we doing that's with the times? And if there's a piece from 15 years ago that still feels like it's with the times, that it resonates, then Sure.
Yeah. So I want to talk about LibLab. So LibLab's been around since 1995 is what I read, which seems like it might have been around longer than most or all of the composer librettist programs that are now in existence. So talk to me about this program and how it operates.
The LibLab is pretty, like, the LibLab is the reason I fell in love with Tapestry. Uh-huh. I have to tell you this, because going back to that point about, like, my friends who were smart, educated people not really getting opera. This was a sort of a point in my career where I was leaving opera as a performer and kind of thinking about, do I direct? Do I do other things? And I came to Toronto because of a fluke kind of, and met the artistic director of Tapestry, was invited to audit the LibLab for a year, mm-hmm. or sorry, for the program. And, just discovered like liquid energy. I went in and just watched all of the things that I didn't think opera could do happen. Like, it was so real, visceral. The creativity was coming from people of all ages. It wasn't about like any specific, like people of all different backgrounds. And the work essentially, like, this is crazy. It's totally crazy. You have the idea in the morning, you write the libretto overnight. It's read the next morning by the performers, bit of dramaturgy. It's composed overnight, delivered at 10 a.m. and then performed at 3 p.m.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's awesome. But just and you know, I've spoken to quite a few librettists. Anna Chatterton and Kanika Ambrose and I believe Lila Palmer, Royce Vavrek, yeah. who've talked about the craziness of what that is.
So. Yeah. Well, and Jessica Murphy Moo, or
that's Jessica right. Murphy? Yes, yeah. Jessica Murphy Moo. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that is amazing about that is it's kind of like so many things in life. Maybe we've learned a bunch in this last year where until you're forced to do something, you don't know how well you can do it in a short amount of time.
Right.
And the other thing is there's three other people who are doing it in that same amount of time. And it's totally friendly competition, but it's like, well, I'm not going to. Like, if they just managed to put out a super powerful work in 24 hours, how did they do that? Yeah. I need to think a little bit more like that if I'm going to do this. So you have four chances, and I call it, you know, it's been called speed, like creative speed dating, but I like to call it like speed failure, because the worst thing is you go into the world, some big company commissions you, it's your first opera, you work on it for months and months and months, you go to the workshop and it's crap. I'm like, that's months and months and months where you just needed someone to help you fail a lot sooner. And in the LibLab, you fail on the first day really hard, usually if you're a first time creator, and you can see what worked and what didn't. And I think that's a really good lesson. The other thing is, like, go with your first instinct, because it's often the best and the most interesting. And if you overthink something, you take away the energy of that idea, of the heart of it, and both in libretto and composition. And that's it. It may be something about opera is like, opera is about big human things. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, you know, that's it. We're lucky because we work with singers who I call the closest to sight interpreters that you can get. So it's not, they can't just sight read. They can also like put character in on the first and second read. And so the amount of information that you're getting back as a creator is incredible. And you're actually getting pretty close to a performance after they've really only worked on the piece for an hour.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. So it like I talked about, it's almost like a drug. Like, the creators go there and they're like, I just had this idea yesterday and now I'm seeing it on stage. How did this happen?
Yeah. Yeah.
and if this is possible, then I need to use these elemental things as best as possible.
How long is the program?
10 days. Mm-hmm. And every creator creates four operas.
Oh my God.
Four, like 5 minute operas, yeah, right. Let's say.
And has it changed a lot over the years? And it's been around for so long. What about it has changed, or has it changed since you've been heading Tapestry?
I mean, just little tweaks. Like, mm-hmm. We give an extra day for the composers on the last two assignments. So instead of 24 hours, they have 48. But
crazy.
I mean, yeah, it hasn't changed too much. I think
that's good.
One of the things that did change is that it was, I think, originally conceived a little bit more as like a commissioning stream activity. It was a partnership between Tapestry and the Canadian Opera Company. What they did was they said, look, this isn't actually the best conditions for creative collaboration because there's that pressure to perform. There's going to be a general director there. He's going to say, which of these groups should we commission? And it takes away that kind of freedom to play aspect.
Yeah.
Because then you're like pressured to perform and you're always trying to do what you think is going to show yourself the best, as opposed to, I have a bold idea and I'm going to go with it. So that was one shift that happened early on, but that did happen before I got there.
Uh-huh.
Other than that, it's like, it does what it does really, really well, which is test the chemistry of creators with each other, because in a tiny amount of time, you're going to find out how well you work with someone really quick. And also test like the magic that's possible with them. So it's about the interpersonal dynamic, and it's about, hey, can they make something that makes me feel?
Mm-hmm. Do participants have to be Canadian?
No, we've had a number of American and international participants. I think we try and keep the balance at least 50% Canadian.
Sure.
But we've also had a couple, like we did an exchange with AOP, American Opera Projects, where we had like four Americans and four Canadians, and did another exchange with Scottish Opera, where it was four Brits and four Canadians. Those were really, really fun and interesting. Cool. Because you're bringing in a different cultural dynamic too.
Yeah. How did LibLab operate during the COVID lockdown? How did Tapestry operate during the COVID lockdown?
LibLab hasn't happened because we had, you know, we're like, we taught ourselves very, very early on in COVID how to remote collaborate, like, I believe we were one of the first companies to be rehearsing on Zoom and mm-hmm. then create video strictly over personal devices and things
like
that.
Was that for Rocking Horse Winter? Did you do that?
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and because we're kind of a community rooted organization, we wanted to pay everybody. And
sure.
We said, if we're going to pay everybody, we might as well learn something. So let's rehearse this damn thing, figure out how to use the tools, and maybe some new tools, and then see if we can produce something that'll be like artistically interesting.
Yeah.
And then out of that, we ended up recording an album for the CBC, and they broadcast it on Saturday afternoon at the Opera, hosted by Ben Heppner. So that was pretty cool.
That's pretty nice.
it's this weird thing. Instead of it reaching like 2,000 people in a production, it reached 300,000 people over the radio.
So small exchanges.
Well, I mean, you know,
it's awesome.
I think we probably still would have rather it been an in-person experience where people had that kind of transformative opportunity. But yeah, I mean, that was our first foray into online collaboration over online tools and recording tools, incorporating recording tools. And then from there, we basically postponed all in-person shows. And then like programmed a whole new season of shows, of concerts and shows,
right,
that we realized really quickly would have to be designed for the small screen instead of for an audience or for the big screen. And then as we're going through that process, we did something that was totally ripping off the LibLab, which was something we now call Opera Writers Room.
Okay.
And where we're kind of combining LibLab with a TV Writers Room kind of feel, but it's not a residency. It's like we're paying professionals to come and play in the room with us. And we took almost all LibLab graduates, and similarly, in kind of like 3 weeks, we created 40 minutes worth of opera sketches.
Uh-huh.
Somewhat loosely riffing off of what Baroness von Sketch does. I don't know if you've seen their stuff.
I haven't.
But like sketch TV, like uh-huh. Saturday Night Live, but for opera. Really thinking that like the internet works really, really well with small bits and bytes.
It does.
And opera is not that. normally. So that was our other kind of COVID-related creative thing, is we just said, let's go for funny, let's go for absurd, and you know, as, throw in a couple of heartbreaking things, and we'll just make them lib-lab size or smaller, and then be able to share them like individually and as an episode. So we've now recorded 3 episodes of what we call SOS Sketch Opera Singers.
Love it.
And yeah, so that's, we're just using YouTube.
Yeah, why not? Yeah. I feel like, you know, it's so interesting to hear how companies pivoted, because it was just an incredible global artistic pivot that had to happen at that juncture. So, I'm happy that you're still creating work. And I did read about Rocking Horse Winter kind of going online. And, so that makes me happy that you were able to still make things. But, do you anticipate that things will come back in the next season, or do you think it's going to take a little longer? Like, I mean, to life. I know it's impossible to predict.
I mean, but. The clarity is improving, you mm-hmm. know. It seems like everyone should have a vaccine, at least in our country, by the midwinter at latest.
Yeah.
Meaning that probably larger venues will be back in early 2022.
Yeah, that's right. Sounds right.
So that's, you know, I feel good about spring 2022. Mm-hmm. And we'll probably, like, we're, the other thing we did was, because I think this, it was around this time last year when we started getting warmer weather again. We're in Canada, so
right.
Don't have the benefit of California.
Yeah.
And we just started seeing everyone outside all of the time. Like, I was running around my neighborhood because my body was atrophying, and I saw like people I'd never seen on their front yards and porches because we had all been sequestered. And then I was like, we should, cause our plan was to do like a summer of digital programming. And I'm
sure.
Like, nobody wants that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody, like, we've spent enough time obsessing over a screen, because that was back when we were like, what are the new COVID updates? What are the new shutdowns?
Yeah.
So we just canned all of our things until the following fall. And, we built a trailer stage, that could be towed behind a car, and we had a one man show
tour
around, for 74 performances.
Oh, wow.
In the summer and fall, where it would just go to where people were, so that, you know, you're in your own safety protocol.
Sure.
And, we'll do that again this summer into the fall.
Great. So you're still out there operating. You know, I read, and obviously it didn't happen, but I read that you were joining forces with Opera de Montreal last year for a bilingual lab. Is that still something that you hope will be able to happen in the future?
Yeah. And, the reason why we postponed LibLab is because you can't get the same, like, intense collaboration without being in person.
Oh, of course.
And, like, without eating in person and having those ideas that come up obliquely. Mm-hmm. I think that's the great mm-hmm. thing, is if we have a conversation and say, okay, we're going to do this about this. Great. Okay. You work, I'll work. But then we turn our Zooms off and we don't have an opportunity to kind of like, hey, I have an idea. It's maybe stupid. Should we talk about it? And that can lead to something else. It was just like, I didn't want to like shorten the creative energy that would happen with LibLab. So we've postponed that. It'll probably happen this coming season, which is super exciting.
As a creator yourself, what do you learn by watching these wordsmiths and composers create together in this sort of time frame?
I mean, that writing is an art. Mm-hmm. And I've... you know, there's a saying, please don't let the composer be the librettist also, because so often they subject themselves to the fallacy that because I know how to write, because I'm an educated human, I can write. And that's true. We can all write a story, but great writers are just thinking in a different dimension. And I think that's what's really exciting about watching amazing story creators in action, is that they're building the kind of nuance in that is, you know, that is, it's art. That's what it is. And I think that what the interesting thing about seeing composers who often come from a place where they work a lot by themselves, they don't collaborate as much as writers who work in theater do.
Sure.
Is exposing that process to the composer and seeing which composers really sort of start to embrace story and complexity in the kind of work they do. And that's a, like, that's where a lot of the aha moments come, because a lot of composers previously, sure, I'll set some text by some dead poet and I make all of the decisions. But no one is really cluing me into the nuances of the human experience. And so many professors make composers think about sound journey as opposed to human journey. In fact, it was like thought that like the narrative, composition from a human point of view was kind of like old fashioned and obsolete. And, it ain't so in opera. And, I love that. I love watching and seeing like both the aha moment of the composer being like, of course there's more than I could have imagined in terms of character and story. And on the other side, the theater people just seeing like the emotional possibility and the story possibility of music.
There's something that I really love. You know, I've spoken to so many librettists who come from poetry or from playwriting or from just who have the same experience as a composer who's used to writing their own words, of that always being by themselves making work and then all of a sudden joining this collaborative process. And I think there's something so interesting about opera, theater in general, but opera specifically, just because of all of its moving parts, how unbelievably collaborative it is and has to be in order to be created. And I find that it starts from the beginning, which I really, really love about that notion that the collaborative process starts from the moment of creation versus later when someone else gets a hold of the work. So yeah, I love that.
There was something about the reason that the LibLab was founded was because Canadian producers were generally experiencing that like 50% of commissions of the collaborations were failing. And this was, I think this was true in the US as well as Canada, a lot of places, because it used to be, you would say, a composer, I like your music, pick a writer and write us a piece. And there was some composer would be like, hey, I like your poetry or I like your book. Let's work together. Sounds cool and heady. And then they would go for it. And then it would 50% or more of the time it would fail because it wasn't about their relationship.
Right.
And so like in this way, I feel like a composer and librettist, and I'm sure like Royce would agree. It's almost like about the kind, like, can the relationship work like a marriage can work? 'Cause you're going to be together for a couple of years. If you're doing a big thing, you have to really turn each other on in the beginning. Like if it's not on fire in the beginning, then it's not going to last through the boring parts. So I love that idea that it starts at the beginning, but it's also kind of about falling in love with each other, in the way that we do with our, you know, with the loves of our lives.
Right. Talk to me about, have any commissions come directly from LibLab that Tapestry has premiered or has worked with?
Most of them. Yeah.
See, oh, that's fantastic. So, yeah. Give me some of your success, like full success stories.
Well, I would say it's like 50-50. Either the work is like the 5-minute piece is like a seed work, where I think we did a piece with Marjorie Chan and John Harris with Scottish Opera and Tapestry. And it was like a Medea scene that they wrote. There was kind of some sort of, it was a Greek prod for the exercise. And then, and it was really exciting. And so they got commissioned to write a bigger, you know, proposal. And then they got commissioned to do the whole thing. So that was that was like a great example of a seed. I think Oksana G as well, Aaron Gervais and Colleen Murphy, similarly was like written as a super powerful scene between a priest and a woman he was helping escape, human trafficking. So obvious, interesting dynamics, in there, and they kind of fall in love, but it's never really openly stated. So that was like the super, super interesting heart of the piece, that was developed in LibLab that ended up being a full feature, like main stage production. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is like when you find great chemistry. And so that's like Anna Chatterton and Gareth.
Right.
They were on fire in the LibLab, and then they were approached by both companies, And they said, it's like, let's find something to collaborate on. And they did some incredible work together for Rocket Horse Winter.
Mm-hmm. That's if someone is interested in being a part of LibLab, I know it's not operating right now, and I know it'll come back. What should they do? Where should they go to find information about this?
They can email me, which you can find on our website, tapestryopera.com. Yeah. I mean, what they should do is they should write some stuff for The Voice, and they should write some dramatic work, because mm-hmm. that's the, it's kind of the thing that's interesting to me is it's not a program for beginners.
Right.
But it's also not a program for people who know how to write opera. So we always like to mix it up with people who are veterans and newer to the genre. Because again, who knows where the dynamic comes from when the spark, you know, strikes flame. But go to our website. We have a waiting list basically, and we will send out a call. And then when that call goes out, you can submit all of your stuff. And we're very, very interested in, I would say, both conventional and unconventional creators.
Michael, thank you so much for speaking with me today. This was a great interview. Thank you.
My pleasure. You're great to talk to.
And here's where I would normally thank Robert Wesley Mason and Michael Morey for speaking with me. But I cut Michael off too soon. As soon as I wrapped up the interview, he told me he had more to say. And how right he was. I'll let him have the final word. Thanks for listening.
It is incredibly appropriate that the opera world is starting to ask questions that the rest of the world was asking 30 years ago in terms of, you know, can we have some kind of representation and equity, and why are we still doing weirdly offensive things to women and to quote unquote minorities when those are now like us? We are a very diverse population in North America. And one of the questions in how we commission work is like, do we have to only work in Western ways? Meaning, do our composers only have to come from conservatories that have basically been teaching in the European tradition? And do our writers need to come from a writing pedigree that follows up on like the Greek establishment of theater? Or do we have more space for people who work with the word in different kinds of ways from different backgrounds, and people who work with music creation from different kinds of backgrounds? And that's like one of the biggest questions that we're thinking about as we head into the next LibLab, and that we've been thinking about at Tapestry when we look at the roster of who can be creating opera. And it gets really exciting because those are super rich strains, but I do think that like we have two pianists and four singers and a couple of directors when we do the LibLab.
Right.
And I'm like, that's already reducing it to piano and voice. And
right.
Yeah. If you think about the grocery store of sound that we have available to us right now, there's so much more than piano and voice. And I wouldn't not want to consider recipes or ingredients. So I think that thinking about iterative creation and starting in ways that are non-scored, for example.
Sure.
I think that there's going to be a huge renaissance in opera when we can find more supportive ways to bring in creators who are already incredible at what they do in other genres or from backgrounds that aren't exclusively European derivative. So that's it's just kind of an interesting question, I guess.
Opening up our periphery into a wider space, what do you think the most difficult part of that is as you look forward towards changing how you...
I mean, like we've been doing... Even before I came to the company, Tapestry's been working with a lot of diverse communities and backgrounds. But usually it was with people who already bridged that through their education. So, you know, we did a major world premiere that exposed the head tax on the Chinese workers in building the railroads in Canada in 2001 mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. Kunning Chan as composer. But again, his training was also extensively in Western classical music. And the challenge, I think, is really in process.
Right.
Because like we work with a bunch of kick-ass singers who can come in and read a score and like act the crap out of it and bring that to stage. But that's predicated on a very condensed process where we can rely on the score to get us really, really far ahead, because right. it's our roadmap. And like the richness of different traditions has either different scoring methods or doesn't score. It relies on like sometimes oral tradition or passed down traditions. And that's where I think we need, it's just time and money. You know, you just need to invest in time and money in order to build out a process that allows for collaboration to be a little bit more iterative or based on other means, mm-hmm. because the score is the thing that keeps people out, because a lot of creators don't use, even in the, like the rock world, we've worked with some punk rock bands and they're like, I don't read music, man. Like,
yeah.
And these, they have like awards on their wall and have been, highly successful, toured with the biggest bands in the world. But it's because how they create is like, let's jam and figure this out. Hey, can we go a couple more hours? And I have to say, look, we have a union for our singers, so they can't.
Right.
But it's a totally legitimate process that we just don't ever take advantage of in quote unquote classical music. And I think that's where it starts to get exciting.
Yeah.
Because you're just playing with a different kind of fire, and that's but it just requires time and thoughtfulness and I think probably leadership from someone with that expertise in addition. So it's not just that we're bringing them in, it's that they're in and they're guiding the process as well.
They've got to be able to talk to the company itself about what they need in order to make the creation happen. Yeah, I, you know, I worked on the mariachi opera Cruzar la Cara de la Luna, and dealing with the mariachi, you know, it's the same thing as like, as you were talking about with like punk bands, and you know, they're incredible musicians, but there are a fair amount of them that actually don't read music. And you, we discovered that speaking in solfège actually was a way to, they could get where they were going, but it was such a learning curve for Houston Grand Opera to just figure out what that communication needed to be in order for the musicians to all be on the same page. It's a very interesting process. But do you also find that just thinking about finding people, I mean, because I'm assuming that you're right, like there are certain people that have various musical traditions and or writing traditions for that matter that could come in and join the process, but to reach further afield means actually, you know, that's a different sort of time and money to be able to really find musicians that might have never thought about this as an opportunity. And
yeah, I mean, and there's two things there. We've got to be able to prove our mettle as a contemporary art form.
Right.
So it means the kind of stuff that we do. Like when we collaborated with the punk rock band, we invited them to the previous experimental show that we did. Mm-hmm. And they wrote us later saying, we thought this was going to be terrible and we came because we were kind of going to groan at it. And then we like stayed up all night drinking and talking about it.
Nice.
And we'd love to work with you. And like, I think sometimes that's the only way to get really exciting, legitimate, music makers outside of the conventional tradition to come in. But yeah, it requires us to be also not in a bubble.
Right.
That is just classical music. We need to be, I think, like the rest of the population, omnivores for art, to know what's interesting and good and vital out there and what's coming up. And then, you know, it also has to be a true exchange where we're not saying, come and make us cooler. It's about like, what can we also offer you, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And also how can we support your art making in ways that maybe, you know, we can do, because of our specialties. So yeah, it's hard. This is the thing. I don't think that, going back to that point about, you know, your journey as a director and seeing things where I think they could have done that better. I think about how many resources go into creating operas right now and how much of that process is not organic, is predicated on people who are still trying to kind of imitate an art form from 100 years ago and
yeah.
don't realize that. And I think that ability for us to just, let's look at what really is succeeding in the world today for new media, and how can we see that kind of resonance should also exist in the work that we do and try and do.
If you'd like to hear these interviews in their entirety, as well as bonus materials and outtakes, you can become a patron of my podcast by going to patreon.com/wordsfirstpodcast. That's patreon.com/wordsfirstpodcast. All of my episodes from every season are available at wordsfirst.buzzsprout.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Words First is recorded deep inside my office closet in Knoxville, Tennessee. A special thanks to Matthew Doucet and Richard Stickan for their generous support, Early Doucet for a beautiful watercolored logo, Eileen Downey for the Mozart, and Randy Ravioli for the minimal barking. Until next time, take care of each other and keep telling stories.